a nuke in his hand. I could feel it. I was there with him. I was with a dead body in a command room, security detail none the wiser, with three guys with codes and their fingers on the buttons. Everyone who knows this guy's a walking stiff locked out of the room. A nun, praying for my clarity outside my bedroom door. A bunch of scared ex-cultists exchanging fire with the faithful down the hall. It was only a matter of time before someone I loved caught a bullet that I couldn't bring them back from. I needed to do something. I couldn't do anything. He said, "Eventually, it was the nun who changed things. She knocked on my door and said very nicely, 'John, how are you doing?' And I said, 'Not great, honestly.' She said, 'John, how close are you to finding the soul?' And I said, 'I can't, sister. It's too big. I don't understand why it's so huge. I can't find the soul inside the body. I don't know where to look. I don't know what I'm doing.' She prayed over me, and then she went away for the longest 5 minutes of my life. Call came down the line that they were trying to evacuate the city around G, but I was all, 'You took too long, you know that won't work,' and they didn't talk to me again. Then the nun came back and knocked on my door and said, 'John, I think I have it. I know you're very scared right now, but I'm going to help you. Please let me in.' He said, 'I let her in. She'd brought P's gun.' As they stood in that filthy hallway, he looked down at the brown collection of clothes and body. She did too, recognizing dimly what she was looking at. He said, 'Don't. This isn't what she looks like.' And he said, as though he were underwater with the rest of everything, 'I guess in all the confusion, P didn't notice it was missing. I thought she was there to kill me. Titania and Ulysses were there, but I didn't have them jump in front of me. I didn't have them stop her. I guess I almost... I was feeling pretty bad, you know. I was feeling pretty shaken.' He said, 'She just smiled at me. She said, 'John, don't misunderstand. I want to help you. I truly believe that in our most terrible hours we don't instinctively reach out to God. We push ourselves away from him. Don't feel bad for not rising heroically to the occasion right now. Fear doesn't help us achieve a state of grace. It deafens the heart. John, I truly believe you can save everyone. So concentrate, please.' She said, 'Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death.' And she shot herself." He said, "Her soul hung there for a second, nothing more. And I tried to keep her. All I was thinking was that I had to save her, had to stop this fuck-up if I couldn't stop any of the others. I'd got a huge injection of the death energy close up, and it was like getting meth injected into my eyeballs. For the first time, I could hold a soul and see its edges, pin it down. It was like a tiny atom bomb. I could tell immediately that this was the missing link, if I could only control it. I should have been able to take that bullet out of her brain and undo the damage, fix the soul back in, bring her back to life," he said. "But I held her soul in my hands, and I knew why it had been so hard, because I was tuned in. I was looking at the code. I knew why I hadn't been able to see anything." He said, "When I touched her soul, I touched you." He said, "You were the noise that was everywhere. It was like trying to talk to someone down a phone line with someone screaming through a megaphone in the same room. You drowned everything out. You were so huge and so complicated, and you were screaming. You wouldn't stop screaming. You were so scared, you were so goddamn mad.
She said, I was.
He said, it wasn't your fault. He said, but that's when I realized you were there, and I realized the soul of a single human being was incredible, but at the same time, incredible small potatoes. I wasn't holding two nukes on the line, I was holding three, and compared to you, the other two were birthday candles.
He said,
I left her dead in the bedroom. Did I take something? I don't think I took anything, not even Ulysses and Titania. I didn't have much blood on me. I wiped it off on her jumper and left the jumper in the bedroom too. Nobody noticed. We had the next problem to hand. While the crazies made us wait, they'd flipped some of the faithful inside the dome, told them I was busy plotting nuclear war or something else wildly unfair. When I walked back into the kitchen, they were all shooting each other. He said, I just kind of stood there and watched it happen, I think. It wasn't like people shooting each other in a movie. You'd have someone shoot someone, everyone would yell about it, then someone else would shoot that person. It was all awkward, like they were angry, but taking turns. A's little brother was there, dead, in the middle, shot from both sides. Nobody likes a peacemaker. The more they shot each other, the angrier they got. I don't think they even noticed me watching them. It was like I was invisible. They made each other dead in front of me, and I felt each one like popping bubble wrap. Only I held on to them. I collected them up. In the next room, I found C and N. They'd shot C first, and right in front of my eyes, they shot N. Pop. Bubble wrap. I don't know what happened to them. This part gets a little weird, you know, like I dreamed it. I remember P behind a barricade, not dead yet, telling me, John, run! I remember A and M, they were alive. We all hid behind a kitchen table. I remember their hands in my hands. I remember A telling me something and M saying, we're together, we'll go together. But they found us. They were already there. They shot A right in front of us, hauled me out. M said, take John alive, he's worth more to you alive. And they shot her.
He stood there and he said,
do you remember what I said was coming?
She said, yes.
He said, this is the part where I hurt you. Are you ready?
She said, yes.
He said, you were screaming. I wanted you to stop. I wanted you. I wanted you like a caveman wants a wildfire or the sun. I thought you were going to take me somehow, purge me, use me as an instrument. But you didn't say anything. I was babbling. Show me. Come on, I'm ready. You kept screaming and screaming like a baby in pain. So I tried to hurt you. I did hurt you. I reached out for you and it hurt you. But I wasn't strong enough. The caveman, the wildfire, the Neolithic priest staggering in front of the falling star.
He said,
I felt P go. G was the last one alive. I reached out and stopped G's heart.
He paused and said,
I'm still sorry it was Melbourne, honestly. Love a working tram service.
Abruptly, he turned around and walked out of the room, passed back into the kitchen. The skeletons knocked holes in the crusted-up glass so that air came rushing through to them, and he rattled the handle of the glass doors until they opened up and he could stand outside on the tiles. He stood there, his eyes glowing like lamps in the shadowed air, and he looked out at the sky.
He said, God, that hurt you. That stung. I ate every single death. He said, I let go. In the body they'd paid me to puppet, I gave the command. That command was heard round the world. So many men with so many fingers on so many buttons. The world went down in dominoes. Launch one nuke, you'll get 20,000 anti-air missiles in response. SAM's sights open up all over the earth like wildflowers. One little nuke, then a lot of bigger nukes. Christ, why'd we have 'em? Nukes into nukes into nukes. They came out of subs and bunkers and scrambled jets. The funny thing is, it was all to try to make the other ones stop firing, like an old comedy sketch. He said, first, I became a demigod. I nearly fell out of my body. I put my hand around half the world's throats. Some of them I managed to snap before they were melted away by nuclear fire. I did them clean. Everyone died, but I helped a hell of a lot of them go before they knew anything had happened. I drank them in, and it wasn't enough. I needed those ships. I needed to extend my hand. I got it around the throat of the other half. I made them go away too. Then I had control of everything on the surface, but not the ships. Birds flying above the fire, kids playing keep away. He said, I put my hands around your neck. He said, I cupped your soul in my hands. He said, I took you into myself and we became one. He said, meditatively, I mean, I tried. There was so much of you. You weren't the small, stained soul of a normal human being. You were so much bigger than that. I opened my mouth and tried to cram you inside. You didn't fit. I dropped to my knees. Here, I believe.
He strode forward. She saw what he was pointing at, a pile of grassless dirt. He said,
so I dropped to my knees here, right? I scooped dirt into my mouth, ate until I vomited. I gathered up the bloody earth. I realized you were too much for me. This is the problem, the incorporation. This is the hardest part. It's the human instinct to take. When you burn your thumb, you stick it in your mouth, right? And there was still too much of me that was just a human being. He said, I didn't stick my thumb in my mouth. Had more sense than that. Fuck knows what would have happened if I tried to absorb you all the way. I probably would have burnt to death. But I needed a house to put you in if I wasn't going to put all of you in me. I made you one on the fly. I wasn't even thinking. I ripped half my ribs from my body and made you from the dirt, my blood, my vomit, my bone. He said, I wanted to make you the most beautiful body I could think of. He paused and said, but I was stressed, okay? I was insane. Most of what had made me John had gone somewhere else. There were a few little thoughts left, a handful of things that made me, a couple scraps of id. It's not fair to judge me, right? I didn't do this thinking. I didn't do it like art. When I was 7, you know, all Nana had to play with in her house was some of Mum's old toys, and my favourite out of all of them.
He gave a long, shuddering sigh.
My favourite was her old Hollywood hair Barbie, he murmured. I loved her little gold outfit and her long yellow hair. She was the best. She got to have all the adventures. There was also a bride's dream Midge, but Mum had cut Midge's hair into this weird mullet. It was Barbie for me.
She looked at him. He looked at her. He added,
not Hollywood hair Ken. Mum had him too, but he was a creep. I gave him to Nana's dog to eat.
He said,
from my blood and bone and vomit, I conjured up a beautiful labyrinth to house you in. I was terrified you'd find some way to escape before I was done. I made you look like a Christmas tree fairy. I made you look like a Renaissance angel. I made you Adam and Eve, Galatea, Barbie, Frankenstein's monster with long yellow hair. He said, as the world went up, I remade us both. I hid me in you. I hid you in me. And when we were together, once the shaman had claimed the sun, I became God. He said, it wasn't enough. He said, the ships were still full of people. I reached our hand out into space. I extended. I struggled. He said, I bit through the sun first. It's human nature. That started things going. Once you take down the sun, you're cooking with gas, pardon the pun. I sliced through Venus, Mercury, Mars. By that point, a couple of the tugs had already launched through the Kuiper. I had to kill Jupiter and Saturn in a fucking hurry. I reached, they blinked away from me. All I could do was hope that they'd watched what I was doing and all died from fucking terror. You and I went full fucking hungry caterpillar. We took Uranus, Neptune, crunched down Pluto, found every satellite and craft, reached in, crunched up all the humans, moved on. I didn't know how to look, you see, only how to touch. The moment I found the fleet spinning up to enter FTL, it was too late. I could only grab one of them, and you and I held it in the palm of our hand. I was in there with them, all those frightened people, all those runaway rats. He stopped. She said, then? He said, then they were gone. Lost to me in time, forever. That'll teach me not to hesitate.
She folded her arms across her chest. She wasn't cold, but she felt as though she ought to be. Standing out in the shadows, in the dust and the dirt, with the reeking concrete shell behind them, she wanted to be cold. He said lightly,
that's it. That's the story. That's what I did.
Oh, she said. Then he said,
do you remember what you said to me once I had done it, when we stood here together?
She looked at him and she said, yes.
He said, you said, I picked you to change and this is how you repay me.
She said, what else did I say?
He said, you said, what have you done to me? I am a hideousness.
She said, what else did I say?
He said, where did you put the people? Where did they go?
She said, I still love you.
He said, you said that too.
28.
Nona woke on the cold, shoe-smelling surface of the back of a truck, in the dark mostly. The seats seemed to close in on her arms and legs, and she panicked briefly, thrashing her head this way and that until somebody said, quite gently,
chill.
The back doors of the truck were wide open. The air was cool and damp and reeked of oil and cold road. From far off, there were the familiar, peppery sounds of gunfire, a yell occasionally, metal creaks and moans that echoed sharply all over the place, as though she were stationed in a deep tunnel. This was because she was stationed in a deep tunnel, she realized. She sat up and looked out the back of the truck and saw blackness stretch before her. Blackness occasionally relieved by pockets of pale pink light, the spluttery tri-hard light you got from solar power, offering little relief to the eye. Much bigger spotlights had been placed at points on the road like windows to some other world, big luminous rectangles suckling on cables that were lying in thick coils over the painted concrete in heaps and snarls. Some of them led back into the truck. And there was Prince Kiriona Gaia, stretched out on the seats, lying flat, looking at her from the shadows with those golden eyes like a dead animal's. Nona looked at her. She looked at Nona. They looked at each other for a very long time. The scarf at Kiriona's neck had been tied back up, and her jacket had been buttoned up, so that you couldn't see her wounds. The corpse prince looked at her, and her expression was flat and cool and metallic. Kiriona said, "Where is she?" Nona didn't know what to say. The corpse prince urged, "Come on, where'd she go? Where is she?"
"I don't know who you're talking about," said Nona miserably.
"Listen, she can be in hell for all I care. I won't get mad," said Kiriona. "She can be at the bottom of the sea or at the bottom of space. I just need to know where."
When Nona didn't answer, the corpse prince said,
"Okay, different question. Do you love her?"
"Take a walk, Nav," said a new voice.
It was Pyrrha, at the back of the truck, looking stretched thin and worn out. There were long, healing grazes going up both of her arms like she'd taken a tumble since Nona last saw her, extending up to underneath her neck. Her stubble was a glittery scrape of red across her cheeks and on the underside of her chin and upper lip. Her hard, familiar face looked impossibly tired. Kiriona said,
"Kind of pretending to be dead here."
"All right, we'll take a walk. Don't go anywhere and stop being a little shit," said Pyrrha.
"It's genetic," said the corpse prince.
Pyrrha got up into the back of the truck, making it jolt and jostle, and shifted cables away from Nona. Nona said, trying to find the words,
"The fingers, the things..."
"The heralds have us pinned down in here," said Pyrrha. "Not that many of them, but even a handful is more than enough."
"Oh yeah, those things are bastards," said Kiriona. "I fought a handful up close, back on the Mithraeum."
"Yeah, well, we fight those things up close, the fight's over. You have to take them out long range. Couple of BOE cars are taking pot shots at them from the on-ramp, about 2 kilometers down. No, don't move, kiddie."
Nona had tried to slither her way up into the halo of Pyrrha's arms and found her legs felt like blocks of marble. They had never felt that way before, sort of fizzy and numb. Sometimes her gang had given each other dead legs and arms, and she had offered herself up for this treatment, but to her disappointment it had never worked on her. Pyrrha cradled her in her arms and worked her way very carefully out the back of the truck. It was dark and echoey outside, with small sanctuaries of light here and there on the oil-smelling road. There was a barrier a little way from the truck, a waist-high slab of concrete. Pyrrha put her down with her back propped against it, then crouched next to her. Nona said, surprised,
"I can't walk."
"Do you remember what happened after you blacked out on top of the car?" asked Pyrrha.
"No," said Nona.
"Maybe that's for the best," said Pyrrha.
Then she opened her mouth and said quietly,
"Eh, don't," Nona found herself saying. "Don't. Don't call me that or anything like that. Don't make me remember. I don't want to. You won't like it. Don't. Don't make me do it."
Pyrrha said,
"Don't freak out, Junior. Cool it."
But she didn't feel cool at all. She felt horribly hot. Something itched wetly and warmly on the back of her neck, and she raised a trembling hand to touch the spot, but Pyrrha took her wrist and said,
"Don't smear it. It's meant to keep you in the body as long as possible."
The grip on Nona's wrist was firm and gentle and totally normal. How many times had Pyrrha grasped her wrist before crossing a road or helping her stand or twirling her around to songs on the radio? But from some hole in the back of Nona's cupboard behind a fake plank of wood in Nona's brain, her voice said roughly,
"Don't touch me!"
Pyrrha dropped her wrist, and Nona's voice went on and on.
"Did you think this was fun, Pyrrha Dvey? Did you think this was lovely? Family, blood, together, kiss, kiss, a child's game.
You say nice words and everyone pretends they are the words you say. Here is a house. We live in it. Worms slithering over each other. Did you like playing pretend? Did you like being mother and father? You should have given in to your desires and eaten us. Chew and swallow. More natural. Would have respected you for it. The voice died away, and Nona, in agonies of hatred and repulsion and embarrassment, tried to curl up in on herself, only it didn't work. She felt as though she had been interrupted in the bathroom. White, hot, fatal shame seemed to start in her middle and travel outward, and she got her own voice and she said, Don't do this to me, Pyrrha. Pyrrha, just let me die. It's nicer. I can't bear it. Nona cried for a little while. The tears oozed out of her eyes and landed in her lap. Her face felt hot, and the back of her neck was sore and itchy. After a while, the tears subsided, and Pyrrha said,
Better?
Yeah, said Nona, and felt her voice tremble, but said more steadily, Yes. Can I have a tissue?
Wait till Cam and Sextus get here. You don't want any tissue that's been in my pockets.
Did they find the 6th house?
Yes, thanks to you. And the megatrucks weren't hard to stop either. The moment Tessaphone grounded the 1st one, the others pretty well gave up. It's extenuating circumstances.
This cheered Nona up a little. That's good, isn't it? Pyrrha's face did not look as though she thought it was altogether good.
Nona, she said carefully. What if I told you I thought this was the end of the line, honey? I'm not sure any of us are getting out of this one.
This cheered Nona up a lot, but she hesitated before saying so. It was an awful relief that she and Pyrrha and Cam and Palamedes were all together, and nobody had to worry about the next day or the day after that, that she could put everything else out of her mind. Violently put everything else out of her mind, and she did not have to try any more. But her relief was hard to articulate in a way that did not make her sound awful. So she simply said, I'll behave.
Let's go see the others, said Pyrrha. You okay to be picked up again?
Pyrrha's boots crunched on the shiny black surface as she carried Nona. A megatruck loomed out of the darkness, blizzarded over with luminous strips, bigger than any truck Nona had ever seen. It was as tall as a house. If it had been driven up somehow next to the classroom building, you could have stepped out of the window and stood on the top. It rose up out of sight, its top lost to the blackness, and was so wide that it took Pyrrha something like 20 seconds to walk around its bumper. A huge shutter had opened, and a ramp had been laid down, and there were people milling around next to a much smaller Blood of Eden truck, with the soldiers laying people down on rollaway beds, checking them over, doing something medical, fluttering in the darkness like moths. Nona noticed many of the people being helped had wide, watery white eyes, just like the makeup that Nona had gotten earlier. The sticky, filmy gazes that had so terrified Honesty's crew. Camilla was sitting in a chair. The chair had wheels. She had a clipboard in her hands, and the body of Ianthe Nabirius was there behind the chair, as Palamedes in his shoulders and the line of his head as ever. Various people tottered down the ramps, assisted by Blood of Eden soldiers, Crown and, astonishingly, Pash, helping an extremely feeble and aged person about Nona's size. Palamedes looked very distracted as they approached. He was saying,
Cam, can we get any update on the tunnels? For fuck's sake, can someone please stop my mother from walking around talking to Blood of Eden? Someone's going to put a bullet in her head. Go ask Kester Chinque to do it. He can actually talk to people, though I think right now he's wishing he never left Coniortus. Where are your fathers? Why is this like herding chickens? Nona, how are you?
Nona felt very lost and astonished and weary. Are all these your family? She asked.
Metaphorically, yes. Literally, it's complicated, he said.
There was a great calm relief in his body, which Nona did not expect. Cam was slumped in her chair and she was about 6 degrees paler than she had ever been.
My mother wanted to meet you. Too bad for her, I assume she's off asking one of the junior officers about the philosophy of violence and how these trucks work and what everyone does for a living.
Most of the people being helped could not stand, and they all looked thin and crumpled and haggard, though quite cheerful in many cases, Nona thought.
Pyrrha looked around and said, Sextus, any heralds get down here, I'm not sure these people will survive.
Camilla said,
They wouldn't.
Her voice was thin, barely a whisper. Palamedes supplied,
They're in pretty poor shape, yes, but there's also everyone in the city to think about. I've tried to explain to them what's happening, and they've got the gist, but before you ask about necromancy, that's right out. The Master Archivist says any display of aptitude on their part crocks them for days. Blinding themselves nearly killed them, and that was when they were much stronger. There's no hope of us taking anyone back to the barracks to work on something as fine-grained as those wards Ianthe left.
Nona felt herself being shunted around in Pyrrha's arms. Her weight shifted from side to side.
Pyrrha said, And Ianthe? Kicking, said Palamedes.
He smiled again.
She's getting lively now and quite shockingly angry. Sextus, said Pyrrha. I'm not used to saying this, but I'm fresh out of plans, and either you're so completely high on lovey-dovey cavalier shit that you've taken leave of your senses, and, you know, fair dues, I've been there, or you know something I don't. It's not that I know anything, Pyrrha, said Palamedes. It's that I'm feeling ready to gamble. In a couple of minutes, once the commander gets back to me with the manual, I'm loading everyone here back into the truck. They're going over it now in case Mervwing left anything untoward inside.
Nona peered around into the truck, into the big well of dim light, and tried to be positive but cautious.
Palamedes, you know I get motion sick.
I know. I'm sorry. You'll only have to put up with it for a bit, Nona, I promise.
Pyrrha said,
Look, I know this thing has the tonnage you usually find in spacecraft, but if your plan is to hoon around the city squashing heralds as you go, I have to tell you, that's not going to work.
Didn't think of that, said Camilla.
Palamedes said,
No, don't worry, Dvay. My ambitions don't extend to the city surface. Hang on, here comes the committee.
The commander and someone that Nona had never met walked into the big yellow square of light in front of the ramp. The commander looked normal, except Nona was struck afresh by the enormous contrast between her and Palamedes. We suffer looked a lot more like Pyrrha, in that she was stressed and wild-eyed and had a fatal brisk focus that was completely at odds with Palamedes's cheerful anticipation. Palamedes was acting as though he were a tiny at show and tell, who had brought in his favourite toy with the expectation that he was about to get 2 minutes all to himself to tell the whole room about it, even the big kids. The crumpled, blind-eyed woman next to We Suffer, who walked with one hand on her gracefully extended arm, stopped in the light. She had quick features and a very long braid of dark, silvering hair, so long that it made Nona wish to have her own braids back. She looked quite old, maybe older even than We Suffer. Marks of deep care delineated on her face, and wasn't glamorous, and wouldn't have been even if she had been in fresh clothes.
"Here's the numbers, Master Warden," she said,
and leant out with a sheaf of paper.
I haven't been able to double-check them. I did an initial calculation, but of course the basic mathematics can't be relied upon. I will say that my computation has come along wonderfully in the past couple of months. We were having quite a fun time in my corner doing quadratics out loud until the chair threatened to toss us out of the truck. How are they?
Palamedes squatted down to check the papers with Camilla. Cam said,
If we could get inside the dome, this wouldn't matter.
I can't navigate like that, Cam. I'm not sure anyone can. I never knew where I was, spatially, and exiting and entering must be hell. We're going to have to do this on the fly. Gideon's ponied up some of the inside layout. Our best bet sounds like their landing platform. If we get anywhere even slightly near it... Pyrrha cleared her throat.
Commander, casualties.
We suffer sighed.
Out of the frying pan, she said, into another frying pan, falling out of that frying pan into the underworld, where there is a huge frying pan where the devils dance and say, fuck to you.
You always had the way with words, said Pyrrha. Are they everywhere or localized?
Tessiphone is at the mouth of the tunnel and further inside. I cannot get good reports. We are doing fine, but we will run out of bullets in a few hours. They are having a veritable orgy out there, and we cannot use explosives unless we want to collapse the tunnel.
And I do not want to collapse the tunnel because there is no getting out.
Roger that, said Pyrrha.
The archivist said, that's a new voice. And Palamedes said cheerfully,
Archivist, this is Pyrrha Dvey, whom Cam and I credit with keeping us alive. Please be very nice to her. The Sixth House owes Pyrrha Dvey everything, barring tenure.
All right, he said, and tapped a knuckle on the sheaf of papers. That's all we're going to get. Commander, I'm about to ask that we put the Sixth House back on this truck. We don't need to be too worried about living space. This is temporary. If you want to pack anything on here yourself, tell me now.
The commander stepped forward into the light. The archivist, Platt, twitching, stepped with her.
Palamedes Sextus, she said. How do you hope to get out of here?
We're heading through the river, said Palamedes. I plan on getting everyone to the Nine Houses, and once we complete the mission, heading back to the Sixth House, which, so you know, is parked on an exoplanet just outside the star system.
Pyrrha demanded,
Are you a fantasist, boy, or only out of your mind? Your calf's the one with no blood left, so there's no excuse for you.
I believe it will work, said Palamedes.
I know it won't. You can't travel the river. You've never been trained, for one thing.
That is the tricky part, admitted Palamedes. But Pyrrha, I've spent time in the river. I've studied it, albeit in a strange and partial way. I think I can accurately navigate.
I don't care how much you learnt in that bubble. You're not a lictor, said Pyrrha. You can't keep the ghosts off. They'll strip you to the bone.
Not this time, said Palamedes, very lightly.
Nona felt Pyrrha's arms suddenly lose their normal, untrembling strength and let her slip down a couple of centimetres until she said urgently,
Pyrrha, you're dropping me!
And Pyrrha gathered her back up.
We suffer said, I need you to tell me you can do this with a certainty.
I can give you 90%, said Palamedes.
Prove it!
Palamedes passed the sheaf of papers back to We suffer. He said,
Mum, can you get Kiana? She should be here, and Cam's dad's.
No, just Kiki, said Camilla. Just my sister. They won't. They might not understand, Warden. The archivist was saying in quite a jaunty and familiar way,
Ah, family matters. Would you give me your arm, Commander? Are you a family woman yourself? Oh, and when was the divorce?
Palamedes wheeled Camilla into the dark, back toward the truck that Nona had woken up inside.
Pyrrha looked after them, her face and eyes wild.
She followed without being asked to, and Nona clasped her arms around Pyrrha's shoulders. She did not understand. The corpse prince was sitting on the back step of the truck when they got there. Palamedes had hit the brakes on the wheeled chair, and Camilla was slumped back in it. Even in the darkness of the tunnel, Nona could tell that she was in a terrible way. She was very calm, but very feeble. Her mouth had gone dark.
No, no more medication, Nona heard her say clearly. Need my head. Want it clear.
Pyrrha sat Nona on the truck step blindly, despite Nona's warning squawk. Nona very much did not want to be sat next to the shimmering white figure of the dead Kiriona Gaia, who was watching the proceedings with the lively interest of a spectator at a ball game. Pyrrha practically stumbled away. She dropped to her knees before the chair and Palamedes. She reached out and took Palamedes' hand and then Camilla's. Her face and hands showed only dumb despair.
"I've loved you too," she said. "Not well, not even wholesomely. I don't have it in me. But I've loved you. In a better world, I'd be able to say, like you were my own. But I don't know what that would even mean anymore. You've been my agents. You've been stand-ins for something I haven't had for longer than either of you can understand. Which is why I'm saying, don't do this. Please, don't do this."
Neither of them answered.
Pyrrha continued urgently. "Understand that once you do this, you can't take it back. It's better to die. There's a power to dying clean, dying free. It's not love what you're about to do. It's not beautiful and it's not powerful. It's a mistake. We didn't even do it right. We were children, playing with the reflections of stars in a pool of water, thinking it was space."
Palamedes stood and Pyrrha stood with him. He reached out and grasped her wrist strongly.
"Whatever you think we're doing, we're not," he said. "Whatever you think you're doing," said Pyrrha, "you shouldn't."
Camilla said, "Just watch us." Pyrrha tugged her wrist free of Palamedes' hand. She reached down and tilted Camilla's chin up and looked at her for the longest time. Then she leant down. She kissed her brusquely and briefly on the forehead, and startlingly and even more briefly on the mouth. Nona, who even then could never ditch the lessons of the hand and the mouth, watched that kiss and felt very sad. It was like watching Pyrrha stealing something she didn't want to take, reaching out for the juicy cherry-red part of the oven, even when she knew that all it could give her was a burn. And Nona saw Camilla with her cold, navy-blue mouth and could tell that Camilla understood. Camilla said, "Could you try not to be such a chicken hawk, Pyrrha?" Pyrrha reached out, ruffled the perfect hair of the body of Ianthe Nabirius, and leant in to briefly kiss Palamedes too. Palamedes said, tolerant and amused,
"You are an appalling old roué, Dve." And Pyrrha said, "Call me if you need me. Otherwise, see you around."
Pyrrha crossed over to the truck, to Nona, and leant heavily into the interior. Nona could see that she was sweating, in exactly the same way she had sweated after the bottle of bleach. She mumbled,
"You knew this was happening. You knew this was happening months ago."
And when Nona put her hand on Pyrrha's, it was like Pyrrha hadn't even noticed her. By now, other people had filtered through to stand in a ragged semicircle around the wheelchair. There was the bird-like lady with the braid, We Suffer, a tall, lanky, creased young woman in grey whose face looked so startlingly like Cam's that Nona wondered at it. Her hair was nearly all shaved off on both sides, and, unlike the others, her eyes weren't milky white at all. They were deep-set and dark in a face like a hawk's. Crown joined them too, golden, shining Crown, another ragged lamp in the darkness. She was tying her fingers in knots, then untying them over and over. Nobody said a thing. Camilla's head was lolled back against the chair, but she abruptly stood on her own power, rolling her shoulders, cracking her neck. Palamedes drew her to sit down on the cold road, and they sat facing each other, cross-legged. It took Camilla a long time to fold her legs, and when she did, she made a kind of deep oof noise that told Nona it had cost her. She drew one of her knives from its holder and laid it down between them on the concrete. All at once, the ragged watchers closed in, just a few steps, so that they formed a ring, not tight enough to smother, but like they were trying to shut out the rest of that vast, empty tunnel, the far-off echoes of bullets. Nona instinctively moved forward and nearly fell out of the truck. Pyrrha caught her up and they sank to the ground together. Kiriona Gaia was staring politely at the side of the truck, as though there was something really interesting on the paintwork.
"Camilla, we did it right, didn't we?" Palamedes said.
And now Nona knew he wasn't speaking to anyone else in the universe.
"We had something very nearly perfect. The perfect friendship, the perfect love.
I cannot imagine reaching the end of this life and having any regrets, so long as I had been allowed to experience being your adept." Camilla Hecht stared at him stolidly, and then burst into tears. She made very little noise, but the tears were violent anyway. Palamedes took her hands and said in distress,
"Come, dear one, don't."
"No," said Camilla, after an obvious struggle to master herself. "No, I'm crying because I'm relieved," she said, frankly, mulishly. "I'm relieved. Warden, I'm so relieved."
"Not long now," he promised.
Camilla took a couple of gasping breaths. It was obvious how much they hurt her. And then she said, "Warden, will she know who we are in the river?"
"Oh, she's not stupid," said Palamedes lightly.
"In the river, beyond the river, I truly believe we will see ourselves in each other as we really are, and I want them to see us. I am not saying this was our inevitable end. I am saying we have found the best and truest and kindest thing we can do in this moment. Tell me no, and we'll go on as we have been, and we'll go on unafraid. But say yes, and we will make this end and this beginning together."
Camilla shivered all over. Then she was at rest. She relaxed her head. The lines of her neck drooped like a flower. She raised it again.
"Palamedes, yes," she said. "My whole life, yes, yes, forever, yes. Life is too short and love is too long."
He demanded, "Tell me how to do it and I'll do it."
Camilla said, "Go loud!" Palamedes took her knife and he cracked open an invisible seam on the end of the handle. A thin trickle of something white and grey and powdery dribbled into his palm. He held it out to her, and Camilla opened her mouth and, to Nona's horror, ate it, whatever it was. He took the knife and he scored her finger, saying,
"Not much longer."
And he pressed her own bloody finger to her cool and bloody mouth, and he said,
"Don't look back. Whatever you do, don't look back."
And they huddled their heads together. They rested their heads on each other's shoulders. Nothing particularly interesting happened until Camilla burst into flames. She blazed like a white candle. She rolled away from the body of Ianthe Nibirius, booted the inert figure away to roll over and over across the road, and stood, stumbling, completely ablaze, a hot white pillar of fire. Nona watched her open her mouth as though she were calling out, but no sound came. She sizzled. Her bandages and clothes and injuries all sizzled. Her hair sizzled. She blackened and wasted right in front of them. Wherever she staggered, she left bloody black footprints, and those footprints curled up in flower-like wreaths of smoke and flame before dribbling to nothing on the road. She dropped to the road as though dying, rolled around in the agonies of the dying, until Nona thought she, too, would die of watching, that she had finally found something so horrible she could die just from seeing it, the worst thing you could ever see in your life. The whole tunnel was filled with sparkling flame and the crackle of roasting human flesh, Camilla's body dancing gruesomely, trying to put it out, a black thing within the fire, then something red within the fire. And then she tried to stand. She arched, trembling, featureless. The flames died. In the darkness, the figure was naked and whole and unhurt. It crouched in on itself, elbows to knees, clasping itself, curled up in a kind of C, and then it said, "Clothes, please." Nona watched as Kiriona started to unbutton her jacket, then thought better of it. The hawk-faced stranger shimmied, completely unembarrassed, out of her trousers, leaving herself in shorts. We Suffer was taking off her heavy coat. As both of them approached, Nona could see that the stranger's hawk face was stony and emotionless, but that there were wet tracks down her cheeks. The naked figure shrugged on the coat, hastily pulled up the trousers, said, "Thanks," and buttoned itself in. And it was just Camilla, after all. Camilla having lost all that fringe and most of her hair except for a charred inch or so. Cam, with new eyes and a new face, for all that they were the same shaped eyes and the old familiar features. But the eyes were a different colour, though Nona could not see what colour from where she sat. All she could see was that they were different, and the features, though in the same order, were making such a different set of expressions. Not Camilla's, not Palamedes's, that it struck Nona all at once. They were gone. They had left her. They were no longer there. Nona lifted her voice and wailed aloud. The new figure broke past We Suffer and the hawk-faced woman and rustled through the pockets of the inert dead body of Vianthe Nibirius, alone and still on the road, loped over to Nona in a way that neither Camilla nor Palamedes had ever moved, but was filled with both of them, long in the leg, easy in the stride, spare and efficient. They held out a lavender silk handkerchief. Nona sniffled thickly and recoiled. "I wanted tissue. That's too fancy," she mumbled. "That's the point," the figure said, and looked at her with a grave smile. "We know there's not going to be a big birthday party anymore, but happy birthday, Nona." Nona mopped her eyes dolefully with the handkerchief. "Thank you," she said. "It's a relief you didn't get hair ties." The new person suddenly whirled around in one movement. They dashed toward the abandoned body of Ianthe Nibirius, an abandoned body that was now propped up on its elbows, staring out with pale, distrustful eyes, an expression on its face of commingled hate and despair. "So there was another way, Sextus, after all," the body murmured. The figure crouched down and extended their arm. "I know how hard it is for you to kick against the goad," said the new person. "But there are more worlds than this. Come with us. We are the love that is perfected by death. But even death will be no more. Death can also die. There's still time, Ianthe. Time for you and for Nibirius' turn." The abandoned body stared at what had once been Camilla's hand, at what once had been Camilla's face, then at the hand again, after which it said brightly, "I bet you say that to all the boys." The body collapsed and was empty, staring up at the top of the tunnel, its eyes strangely white and silent.
29.
They loaded everyone back into a single truck. Nobody seemed annoyed about this, even though Nona knew they had been on the trucks for months. Maybe once you were on a truck long enough, you forgot that there was anything but the truck. To Nona, it did not seem like a nice kind of home. She kept thinking in a welter of heartbreak about her bedroom, her mattress, her blanket. She had started thinking of bed in a kind of longing, desperate, hungry way. Pyrrha had taken the wheeled chair that Camilla had used and sat Nona inside it. Camilla, Palamedes, the new person, did not need any kind of wheeled chair anymore, or pain medication, despite having been nearly dead. With enormous energy, few words and a clipboard clutched in their hands, Palamedes and Camilla herded all those bent down, exhausted people. They stopped every single one briefly and patted them over and said things like, rehydrated, or try walking on that, or fixed the kidneys, take better care of them. Somehow, simultaneously, they took measurements, all while moving like someone Nona had never met. She fell back entirely on Pyrrha, who seemed as absolutely out of her element as Nona was.
How much to ride the merry-go-round? Said someone familiar.
It was the angel. The angel and Pash appeared in front of Nona's chair, before the truck, and with them, most wonderfully, Noodle. Noodle, sitting on the ground, opening his mouth and panting, closing his mouth and rolling his eyes with displeasure, obviously as past the events of the day as Nona herself. Pyrrha said with a flicker of old humour,
How much to get off?
More than we can afford, I guess, said the angel. She was looking composed in a long canvas coat like the one we suffer had given up, with a long bag slung over her shoulder. Pash wore two of the same, one over each shoulder, with a third in her hand. Sometimes I feel as though I were born on the merry-go-round. I worry I won't know what to do with myself when it stops, if it ever stops. Nona, having seen the bags and Noodle and the leashes, found eagerness enough within her to say, Are you coming with us?
Probably not, Kiddy, said Pyrrha.
But Pash said unexpectedly,
This is the fucking stupidest idea in the world, but yeah, we are. I go where this goes.
A violent jerk of the head in the angel's direction.
And I guess this one is getting on the bus.
To the Nine Houses, said Pyrrha slowly.
Yes, said the angel.
The very centre of the Emperor Divine's power, said Pyrrha.
Pash said, Don't even start, you'll set me off again. We go where we're sent, and this city's a death trap. I don't know, I would have moved out into the tunnels and tried to get clear of the city that way, but...
But I exist, said the angel. Pardon, we exist. And as long as we exist, we are a terrible liability. The commander will get some breathing room if she doesn't have to take us into account with every movement.
Pash said roughly, The commander's probably dead the moment we walk out of here.
We have left many wing commanders behind to die, said the angel calmly. This wing commander is particularly cunning and particularly brave and particularly determined. But get used to it, Passion.
We've been weighed, she shouted out,
and waved her hand at the figures of Palamedes and Camilla and We Suffer in the distance, and they waved back.
Nona said, Who are you? Then she explained, Everyone asks me the same question, so I feel like it's my turn.
You don't get to ask, said Pash roughly,
which Nona thought was a wonderful and very cool answer she wished she had come up with herself. But the angel leant down and looked at Nona. There was something settled in her face, a calmness that had not existed there before, a kind of immovable, fixed concrete resolve. She had never seen the angel look like that. Every furtive, fleeting, mercurial spark had gone, leaving something hard and old, something that touched light to some paper deep within Nona. She suddenly reached up and grasped the angel's hand. And the angel grasped hers, and the angel looked at her.
I'm the messenger, said the angel simply. We are the message. The message has two parts left, and you are looking at one of those parts. The name for this part of the message was AIM, when the message was passed to us through my forebear, Emma Sen. The message is too simple for human beings like us to understand. What do you think the message is?
Nona couldn't guess.
I hope you hear it one day, said AIM. She reached out. She ruffled Nona's hair. She smiled. Then she said, Noodle, let's go. And she stepped resolutely up the ramp and into the truck.
Pash dithered behind a little, a more subdued and unsure Our Lady of the Passion.
She said, I have to shoot you now. And then she burst out quickly, Joke! That was an actual fucking joke. You don't even need to pay for it.
And she followed the angel up the ramp. Pyrrha leant down and plucked Nona out of the chair. Nona was bewildered to find that her arms were now betraying her too. When she tried to place them around Pyrrha's neck again, they too had become something more like rocks and ice. Pyrrha put them around her shoulders and said,
"You've been very calm."
Nona found herself saying,
"It's not long now, is it? Are we going to find me?"
"Yeah," said Pyrrha. "I think it's time to wake you up."
The megatruck on the inside was a long corridor of little cubicles. Pyrrha avoided these cubicles and instead travelled up a short flight of metal stairs to another compartment. She opened a door and she brought Nona into an enormous cockpit with wraparound windows, the most complicated car insides that she had ever seen. Pyrrha sat down on a chair made of shiny, soft, cracked stuff, worn at the seat from too much sitting down. The windshield was a huge black expanse, strung with the few lights lit in the tunnel and otherwise looking like the blackness at the bottom of the world. The corpse prince was already in the cockpit. She had apparently walked there under her own steam. If anyone from Blood of Eden had noticed, they had kept it to themselves, and now she was strapped into one of the sideways seats, her sword beneath her feet, legs splayed carelessly wide at the knees, arms folded over her chest. She did not speak to them, even when Pyrrha said,
"Hey, kid."
She had not said much of anything since Camilla and Palamedes had become Camilla and Palamedes, seemed withdrawn and lost in thought, unwilling to look at anyone or anything. Camilla's body appeared at the doorway. The commander was there with it, and Crown was close behind, with the captain's arm around her shoulder. The captain seemed to be able to stand up now, but was staring, dumb and dull, as though she didn't understand her surroundings. Supporting her must have been awkward, but Crown didn't seem to notice. Crown flashed a smile at Nona. She even smiled at Kiriona before sitting down in one of the front row chairs. Camilla and Palamedes selected the biggest chair of all, right at the front, before the enormous wheel. "Mind showing me how this thing starts?" they said to the commander.
"Oh, dear God," said the commander. "For what I am about to do, I will go down as history's greatest monster."
But she leant over and she said, "Ignition is there. Those are the three brake lines. The lights will need to be green before you hit the ignition. This will start the automatic checks. Press this button to indicate you have read them, if you flip that switch, and do not flip it before everything else has gone green. It will free this lever, which can be manipulated forward, and the wheel turns, although it will also turn automatically with the wall detection. Do you have that?" Pyrrha said,
"Please, let me drive."
"No chance," said Palamedes and Camilla comfortably. And, "Commander, thank you. Leave everything to me."
"I do.
I have," said We Suffer. And,
"Every single hope of Eden now rests within this clapped-out vehicle."
"Same for the Nine Houses," said Palamedes and Camilla.
"You know what I want," said We Suffer.
She turned to address the rest of the driver's cockpit.
"To complete what she started. Troya, listen to me. Every so often there is invoked a Blood of Eden mission protocol. We call it Protocol 1. It is used in times of either terrible joy or the worst possible outcomes. Protocol 1 means there are no more formal orders. If given in the field of battle, often it is understood as scatter, retreat, disunite. But it is not quite that. There is a different protocol that is simply used for retreat. Protocol that means save yourselves. I received the order to save myself when I was young, and I saved myself, which is why you hear me now, starting this terrible truck, putting my life's work in the hands of my enemies and of strangers I do not understand. But now I give you Protocol 1, and Protocol 1 is live."
Crown saluted. Pyrrha looked at the commander, and she saluted too, a slightly different salute with her hand over her heart. Palamedes and Camilla turned around in the seat and they said,
What mission protocol are you about to give Blood of Eden?
We suffer flapped her hand dismissively.
Oh, a very common one. It is basically fight like hell and do not shoot any civilians. We can do that one any day of any week.
I only wish civilians were not so dumb, like rocks are.
Lieutenant, crown him with many crowns? Good luck. Pyrrha Dvey, I am amazed to say this, but I wish you luck.
Nona, I wish you luck.
You.
We suffer paused. Camilla and Palamedes cocked their burnt head to one side.
Paul, they suggested.
Paul.
Good luck, Paul, said We Suffer. Now, you have my coat, which you can keep.
But my wallet is in the breast pocket, so hand it over.
Palamedes and Camilla, Paul, obediently dislodged the wallet and handed it over. We Suffer said,
Now I will give final orders to AIM and Lieutenant Our Lady of the Passion. I will also say goodbye to Juno Zita, who I understand is your mother, and who is an extraordinary lady who has already memorized the names of various people in my family.
We Suffer turned around and walked out without ceremony. She paused only for one long last look at the corpse prince. Nona noticed that Crown held her salute for a long time after the door shut behind We Suffer, and only reluctantly let her hand drop.
Buckle in, said Paul.
Pyrrha tested and tightened the seatbelt over Nona's arms and asked,
How long were you planning this one?
They had a lot of rainy day backup plans.
Yeah, but Paul.
Just Paul, said Paul.
Crown suggested.
Paul Hecht.
Just Paul, said Paul. Ulap, said the corpse prince from the back of the cabin.
Thanks for your contribution, said Paul.
Ulp, said the corpse prince.
No, said Paul.
A light started flashing on the megatruck control board. Paul leant over and touched the button, and We Suffer's voice crackled through.
Troia Cell, do you read? You're clear. Goodbye and good hunting.
Troia Cell copy.
Good luck, said Paul,
and a little laconically.
See you soon.
You have a big ego, she said. I enjoyed that. It is a good and terrible sign. Tessiform 1, out.
Paul settled back in the chair and buckled in. Nona watched as Paul depressed a button until the lights flickered green. A pleasant ding sounded as a screen rolled across the front of the big blackness, as the lights in their little cabin dimmed into nothing, and as a long squiggly readout filled up fully a third of the glass. Paul tapped a button. The readout shifted smoothly over to one side and flipped a switch, then freed a lever. There was a deep, smooth clunk all around Nona, insulated by dint of being in Pyrrha's lap, and also by her body feeling so strange and numb. A huge light swept out in front of them. The headlights from the megatruck had come on automatically, so that there was the darkness and the road and the beams of light. The truck began to roll forward. Pyrrha leant back in the chair and said,
Okay, what now?
This, said Paul.
Paul released a lever, and the truck lurched forward into the darkness. They settled their hands on the wheel. There was nothing in their face but easy surety, not one trace of pain or fear or worry. Everyone had at least a slight trace of anticipation or pain or fear or worry, but not this new person called Paul. Nona felt the truck accelerate. The light ate away the darkness, and a huge, heavy chill settled into the cabin. Nona's breath started coming in frosted pants that hung before her face. An urgent whirring started at the front of the cabin. A white, thick fog of condensation had started to build at the bottom of the glass, and then the heater kicked in and it melted into rivulets of water that pooled down, then abruptly started to run upward, up the windshield glass. Paul leant forward on the accelerator, and then...
John 5:4.
In the dream, they were back on the beach with their backs to the sea. The sand was soft and wet and grey, so fine that it dried as they plucked at it, then crumbled through their fingers like ash. The beach was a long, smooth stretch, relieved only by hummocks, here and there, of thin grass and silvery driftwood sticking out of the dunes like exposed bone. He was scooping indentations in the sand, making big print-block child's letters with the tip of his forefinger. As she watched, he made a pothook, J, then the finned spine of E. He wiped that E clean and replaced it with A. He wiped that clean, and he drew the prison bars of H. This J and H he barred around with an uneven heart. She watched and she said, "Teacher, may I ask a question?"
"Sure," he said, surprised,
and he shook his fingers free of clinging sand.
"Shoot."
"What does it mean to love God?"
"Decent dinner and a bottle of average rosé, maybe a movie. I'm not picky," he said.
She said less patiently, "Teacher, what does it mean for a child of the ninth to love God?" The razor-sharp grasses lay in a shivering mat, cuddled like fearful animals as the wind swept over them. Fine, salty fragments got inside the corners of her mouth. He said, finally,
"You live in a darkened house, and in your darkened house are infinite rooms. By the light of a dying candle you cross the room, knowing that when you reach the threshold of the next room you'll be gone. The candle passed to someone whose face you can't see clearly."
She urged, "Is God the flame? The light? The candle?"
"The love of God is the trust that you won't have to illumine that darkness alone," he said.
She said, "After this, you'll resurrect them."
"Yes," he said, as though halfway dreaming.
He stuck his finger in the sand and made a hole so deep that water glimmered at the bottom. Hypnotized, he did it again.
"Yes, once we've rested. No, we'll do it before you've rested. You can rest afterward. Resurrection is different from waking up. We'll get them all back. Some of them, anyway. Or at least the ones I want to bring back. Anyone I feel didn't do it. Anyone I feel had no part in it. Anyone I can look at the face of and forgive. And my loved ones, the ones I left, I'll bring back. I know I can. Even G. In fact, G'll be easiest. He won't remember the compound. None of them will have to remember anything. I know where remembrance lives in the brain, and he won't have any of it. You know that too, don't you? It's the easiest thing in the world to forget."
She said, "To forget? Everything?"
"Yes," he said, and more sharply. "Yes, it's the only way."
"Teacher, why?"
"They won't forgive themselves," he said. "They'll spend the rest of their lives asking what ifs. What should we have done? How could we have done it differently? Did you need to do it? And I did need to do it, Harrow. There was no other way. Once those bombs were going off, there was no hope for Melbourne anyway. G was dead meat."
She said, "You said that G's bomb went off first."
"Yeah, it did," he said impatiently. "Of course it did. Look, what does it matter? In the end, why the hell does it matter? Only one thing matters now."
He smoothed over the holes, covered them up in a slight leaden depression, a wave of his hand across the surface. Wet sand banked up on either side.
"I still have breath in my body," he said. "They are still out there. There can be no forgiveness."
"For whom?" she asked. For a long time he did not answer. Then he said,
"Do you remember what happens now?"
Harrow Hark Nona Jesmus stood up. She brushed a few traces of sand off her trousers. She wiped tiny motes of rock from her eyes, and she heard the sea behind her, moaning soundlessly as it ate into the beach. She looked up to try to find the poisonous yellow fog, the degraded land, the torn-up buildings and flooded skeletons of towns. But there was nothing. Just the beach and some foothills below the beach.
Yes, she said. Through her, I've seen it. You resurrect some of them. You wake up fewer still. You start out with a few thousand, then later some 100,000, then millions, but never more than millions. You teach them how to live all over again. You teach yourself. You work out how to repopulate the installations on each planet, or to finish the work begun before the bombs, or to improve on it. It's easy. You're God. Your energy is limitless and you can sustain your theorems without a thought. Forget about them. Because she is so enormous, and you and she are one. She understands at this point that she does not have to die, that she can never die if you're alive. And she's scared to die. You're afraid of so many things, but she's only afraid to die. Then, when the disciples come to you and say the word lictor, she does not understand that they want the thing you did to her. She watches as you watch. Watch them misunderstand the process. He looked up at her, squinting his eyes against the white and merciless sun.
God must be able to touch all of creation, he said.
I don't...
You said it yourself. I can't die if she's alive. She can't die if I'm alive. Why would you let something like that run around, Harrow? Why would you let someone go away from you, untouchable, two people? I couldn't. I loved them too much. I saw the face of Earth and choked the life out of it and ate it whole. Oh, I knew I was on the clock for the resurrection beasts. I pretended she was the only one, but I knew the others were coming. I needed my loved ones to be something I could touch, needed them to be my hands, my fingers. There can be no forgiveness for those who walked away, he said, just as there can be no forgiveness for me, even though I rip the very fingers from my hands, throw them into the jaws of the monsters who hunt me, as I run from them across the universe, end to end. Something will satisfy them eventually, but nothing satisfies me. Nothing.
He drew his gaze away from her, his black and white thonic stare, and looked out over the dunes.
He said, "But that's the grace of it, Harrow. If I'm God, I can start over. The flood, you know. You can wash things clean. That's all the end of Earth was, making things clean. It gets dirty again. You clean it again, like those old power-washing ads. Spray and walk away, right? Sometimes I think the only reason I haven't done it already is that I can't bear the idea that I wouldn't be able to touch them, that they'd still be out there. Maybe that's why I made the tomb, Harrow. It is the death of God. It is the apocalypse, because it's my self-preservation in a box."
She said, "Teacher, there's one thing I don't understand."
"There are multiple things I don't," he said.
She said, "I want to understand why she was angry. I want to understand the mathematics, now that I've seen them for myself. I want to know how many of the resurrection are left, and how many you began with, and what the discrepancies are. I want to know where you put them. They didn't go into the river. I want to know why she was angry, and why you were terrified."
She looked away from him, and she said,
"I want to journey to find God. Maybe at the end of that road I will find God in you, teacher. The God who became man and the man who became God. Or perhaps the child of the nine houses will recognize a different divine. But I am the reverend daughter. I am the reverend mother, the reverend father. I must find God, or some aspect of God, and understand it for myself, even if she lies right now within the tomb."
He stood. He was taller than she was. She was not afraid. He reached out a hand to her and placed it upon her shoulder and looked at her, wondering, with his ordinary face, If she had suspected his fear might manifest itself yet again as an act of murder, she could not see that in him now.
"God is a dream, Harrow," he said very gently. "You all dream me together, and she's dreaming me too. In a way, her dead dreams of God mean more than all your dreams put together. In this dream of yours, where will you seek out God? Where will you go?"
Harrow turned away from the hand and crunched out barefoot over the wet sand. Her feet slapped with each step, and she stood ankle-deep in the river, disbelieving. Before her, the waters parted, speared through and mute for the enormous lance of a tower that had never been there before, a tower that soared, impossible and deadly grey, out of the waters, a tower of grey bricks lurching out of the river as though gasping for air. An impossible cone-capped tower, a belled tower. She could see the steeple, but the bellcot was too far from shore to see the bell.
"I'll start there," she said,
and she stepped into the river. She took another step, and she walked, and she walked.
30.
When Nona's eyes opened, it was still dark, but then the darkness changed. It thickened, then resolved, then turned grey, then turned transparent. There was a huge roaring pop within her body's ears, and then they weren't in the tunnel at all. They weren't in anything. The space between the windshield and whatever was out there wasn't space at all. It was as though someone had thrown a bucket of grey paint over the windshield. She couldn't see out. Nona stood up, or at least her body stood up. She was nauseous and thought that if she stood, something would be left on the chair or stuck within Pyrrha's arms. The belt of the chair broke as she stood. Pyrrha reached out for her. She brushed Pyrrha's arm away. Her legs still felt like distant nothing, as did her arms and her trunk and her neck. But her eyes could still see, and her ears could still hear, and her tongue could still taste. When she opened her mouth so that her tongue could taste, it helped her to see a little better. Everyone was talking, talking, talking. Pyrrha was saying something. Paul was saying in calm repose, "No, I've bubbled us." And all Nona caught of Pyrrha's response was, "Not enough. I'm not saying velocity exists here, but untethered, but if you want to get into the current, you'll..." Crown was whispering in her softest and most coaxingest voice, "Judith, won't you come back to me? Judith, Jody." And of course, the captain wasn't saying anything back. Pyrrha swung around to the corpse prince and said, "Kid, you still in there?" And Kiriona said scornfully, "It takes more than this." Nobody was speaking to or noticing Nona, until Nona's hand tapped Paul on the shoulder. Paul looked up into her face with a grave play of understanding flashing across Camilla's once familiar features, the unfamiliar eyes with their deep slate dot in the centre. Nona took a long time to examine those new eyes and decide what she thought of them, whether she liked the pupil that was that cool grey-brown, the iris of clear and limitless grey. Her mouth said, "I'll take it from here." Paul looked at her one final time, then unbuckled, moved aside, steadied themselves as Nona sat in the chair. It was made for someone longer, and her leg did not reach the accelerator. So Paul extended one leg and pressed down with a foot, and braced against the chair and the side of the console. Nona said, "Your thing, the outline, won't work. Don't ask me questions." Paul said, "That skin's all that's lying between us and certain death." Nona's eyes dazzled. Her body shuddered beneath her. For one of the first times she acknowledged it, she felt the body as something with her, on top of her, but not her. Her sense of living outside it. There was a fragile, palpable ecstasy in that body. It was like one of the soft blue jellyfish in the harbour, with all its stings and promises, and now known as self, known as thoughts, were a hand closing around the jellyfish, unbidden, feeling it undulate blindly between the fingers. And the more she felt like fingers, the more she closed down. Somewhere in that shimmering space between fingers and palm, she heard a voice, Pyrrha saying,
"Kitty, stay with us."
So Nona stayed.
"Don't say things that are questions but aren't said like a question," she said eventually, letting her voice rush out without thinking about it. "Take it away. Take it. We don't need it. If you ask more questions, I'll want to answer them. Take it away," I said.
Paul considered this.
"Okay,"
Pyrrha said.
"Wait! Hang on!"
But Paul had already obeyed. Nona felt it, the pop. The grey flapped and peeled away from the windscreen. Pale light poppled in, and the whole windshield exploded into vision. Before them was water, and the megatruck drove along its surface. There was limitless nothing above its surface, something that wanted to look like a night sky, maybe, or a purpling storm with winking lights like stars or lightning, and it stretched without relief over and above that water. Dirty gouts of foam were being spun up by the mega truck's tires and undercarriage as it sped along on top of the water, and that obscured the space and the water and everything, until Nona heaved herself forward on the wheel and spun it hand over hand. It was good to let her hands do things. They knew how to do things she did not know how to do. That raised a huge cloud of foam. The megatruck lurched to one side and everyone was holding on to things, and everything that hadn't been secured tumbled to the other side of the cabin. Yells echoed softly through the door behind them. Paul, light on Cam's feet, reached forward over Nona's shoulder, and the windscreen wiper started a huge screech, screech, screech across the windshield. Pyrrha said,
"This is impossible. We should be flayed alive." And Paul said,
"Yeah."
Nona tried to explain.
"The water doesn't want to touch us, that's all."
Crown was saying urgently,
"Judith, stop, come back."
And Nona vaguely heard unbuckling. And then shadows fell over her. People standing behind her seat. Lots of people had crowded around behind her now. Nona wasn't sure she liked it.
Pyrrha sucked in her breath and she said, "What the fuck is that?"
"Told you so," said Kiriona Gaia.
As the megatruck spun around, the wide, rippling grey waters resolved into something totally different. There was a big structure standing up out of the river. That water was the river, after all. A tall, cold cylinder of what was unmistakably stone. The waters parted around it, and each bulgy wave slammed into it as though trying to bring it down. But it was as hard and inexorable and real as the water in the sky seemed faint and fantastic. Nona thought it looked like something out of a picture book, and held on to that thought, that middle-of-the-brain thought. There was a thought above and below that knew what it was, but the moment she looked at either thought, she'd lose the game. The captain's voice was like old teeth.
"He left them too long! You left them too long, my salt thing!"
"You are here," said Nona, finding talking was hard, that her voice sounded drowsy in her own ears.
"Okay, good. The water really won't touch us. I was worried about our back end."
Paul and Pyrrha flinched hard away from that voice, dived to the other side of the cabin, wheeling away as though struck. This meant that there wasn't a foot on the accelerator, and Nona had to slither down in her chair until she was pretty well staring at the top of the windshield just to keep the megatruck going. A recorded voice said,
"Auto-acceleration enabled,"
and a little bell made a nice little tinkle, so she slithered back up and left it. The tower was so big. As the megatruck approached, she began to realise how big.